You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
All the girls are complicated. Everyone is precious too, and you might get lucky if you do. Oh, you might get lucky if you do. Find the one that makes you laugh. Find the one that takes your breath, where you won't get everything that you want. Oh, but you'll need one to dote upon.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 172 of the Christian Feminist Podcast. I'm Christina Bieber-Lake, and with me today are the regulars and friends, Katie Grubbs and Victoria Reynolds Farmer. Hello, Katie and Victoria.
Hi.
Hi.
All right, so let's introduce ourselves for anyone who might be new to the program. So, Victoria, why don't you start us off?
Sure. Thanks, Christina. Hi, everybody. I am Victoria Reynolds Farmer. I am one of the founders of the Christian Feminist Podcast. I have a PhD in literature and gender studies from the Florida State University. I live in a suburb of Atlanta with my husband, Michael Farmer, of the Christian Humanist Podcast. My day job is in customer engagement for a market research firm in the agriculture space, and in my free time, I do this podcast. I read and write and think about gender and embodiment, and I play the ukulele.
Super. Katie?
Hi, I'm Katie Grubbs. I live in Leeds, Alabama, with my husband, David Grubbs, also the Christian Humanist Podcast, and our four children. I am adjunct professor of English at Houston Baptist University. Obviously, my teaching is fully remote because we do not live in Houston anymore. So I teach English writing and literature classes for HBU. And then in my spare time, my main job is caring for our children. We have four kids, all 10 and under. And then in the spare time that I do have with these other things going on, I enjoy reading mystery novels. And I also am involved in women's Bible study at our church.
Just want to say, Katie, that every time you do a show with me, I'm like, you have four children. How do you have time to do this show? And I'm like immensely grateful. That's just crazy. So I'm Christina Bieber-Lake. I teach English at Wheaton College, which I've just started my 24th year. So I'm getting to be an old pro.
Wow. That's so impressive.
It's a lot of years.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And yeah, I'm really excited to be doing this topic today, so I might as well get started on introducing it. We are talking about Roxane Gay's book, Hunger, which I picked up, I don't know when, and I found it on my shelf, and I started reading it, and I was like, oh, we got to do a show on this. And so I was really elated that Victoria and Katie wanted to talk about it with me. I just want to give, our knowing reading and passing on structure, just give a little bit of background about the book before we get started. Roxane Gay was herself born in 1974, so she's, sort of in her 40s still, and most known for the collection of essays called Bad Feminist, which she wrote in 2014 and became a New York Times bestseller, and that put her on the map, gave her a really good platform for writing this book, which was immensely more personal and really made a splash when it came out. And I wanted to point, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about her background, but she has serious academic credentials, has taught at Eastern Illinois, Purdue, and Yale. And there's just no doubt that she knows her stuff academically as a feminist, and that she is very tried as a writer and a speaker. So I think all of those things make this book especially important for us to discuss. So let's just start the conversation with how we reacted to reading this book on a gut level. Any initial responses from you all?
It took me a while to get into the book. I didn't really understand the form at first. I took note of the part of the book where I really started to like feel it and understand what it was trying to do. And that's page 172, which is slightly more than halfway in. So the beginning took me a while for reasons that I will get into later. But primarily, this was a really emotional read for me. I had to take breaks and put the book down and physically step away. I like Roxane Gay, though not to the magnitude of the events she details, have been sexually assaulted, and that was a kind of triggering read for me. Mm-hmm. It ended up being a good experience overall, but I did have to kind of step away and take breaks and decompress.
Mm. I totally know what you mean about having to take breaks from the book. I had not had that particular experience, but it's just so raw and so personal and so spot on about our kind of cultural expectations of women that it's really hard to read. Was that your experience as well, Katie?
Yes. It was kind of, I kind of had a two-level response, because on the one hand, it was really, really difficult to read. And I've never experienced anything like that. And so can't begin to understand exactly the feelings that she's had. To me, it should be difficult for anyone to read about anyone having to go through something like that. I don't know how one could read this book and not be very disturbed by the things that occurred in her life. At the same time as I was having that more kind of emotional reaction to how raw and intense that were the things that she was describing, I also had a much more, in other parts of the book, had a much more surface level kind of identification with different kind of phenomena in our culture that she talked about with regard to weight loss. There were other parts of the book that I definitely related to, but more purely in the realm of, like you said, Christina, the expectations on women with regard to weight, or the ways that often our society treats people who mm-hmm. are carrying more weight than others in their bodies. And so it was a kind of a weird experience of feeling, of identifying very strongly with certain parts of the book, but then feeling like I was very much in a different territory for myself, in a really hard territory. And Victoria, I get what you mean about the form. I actually enjoyed it. And I really appreciated her guts in just going for this very loose structure, and in a way that felt kind of disjointed, because to me that feels very true to the way that I'm sure different parts in her life, this event and these issues have loomed larger, and then at times they might have receded, but then it comes roaring back again in the way that trauma can. And so I felt like that it was a really interesting and important choice, but I agree with you that it there were times when it felt slightly disorienting. I kept trying to find myself trying to put together the timeline of different people that she mentioned, knowing at different times at different places that she lived. And I finally just like surrendered to the story that she wanted to tell and stopped trying to figure out exactly when all these things happened.
Yeah, I agree with you there. It took me, I kind of got mad at myself actually, because I feel like it took me too long to realize that the form was kind of integral to the content of the book, that you're exactly right about how trauma sort of hides and works and comes back and isn't linear. But the moment where I kind of got angry at myself was I was reading this book. I started reading it the first time on a plane, and I'm sort of, you know, going through it and taking notes and trying to figure it out. And I heard myself think to myself, this is too much. Like it's too many pieces. It's too much. And when I heard myself think that, I was like, oh, like maybe that's what it's about. Like this is about that muchness, both mm-hmm. physically and emotionally. And if I'm made uncomfortable by that, what is that about?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so once I sat
that's a great insight,
with that,
Victoria.
Yeah, once I sat with that, I was like, oh, okay. Like, now I have a deeper understanding of what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting, isn't it? Because we're all trained as literary scholars, and that we could have a moment where we just don't really fully get, oh, the form is totally, totally adhered to the content, is kind of funny, right? And then have that shock of recognition. Oh, of course the form almost has to be this, right? We can go ahead and talk about that issue first, if we want to. How is the form important? What works about it, and what doesn't work?
What didn't work was me at first.
Okay.
I think that was a reader error. My inability to kind of surrender myself to what the book was trying to do. But in terms of form, we should say that there's not really a standard chapter length here. There are some chapters that are 10 or 15 pages, and there are many chapters that are 1 or 2 pages. So it feels kind of voluminous in scope. And as Katie said, it goes back and forth in time a lot, sometimes with no thread. You just kind of skip forward and back, and thinking of that nonlinear structure as a reflection of trauma, I think, is useful. Mm-hmm. Because the way we think of our lives is not linear. Things will spark memories, and people will be connected to other people sort of emotionally in our brains, even if they weren't in the same place or at the same time. So if you can kind of think of this memoir as a very visceral reflection of visceral human experiences, you can understand more what the form is doing, and mm-hmm. maybe you will be more charitable than I was on my initial read through.
Yeah, and it's not only trauma that works like that, right? That kind of comes into focus and brings stuff back from the past, but the fact of having a body at all and being constantly, because she's overweight, reminded of being in this body that other people do not accept. Right. So it's as if her body is always coming back into her own consciousness. Right. Just you can't escape it. It's an inescapable body. I mean, none of us can escape our bodies. Right. So it's just it's just coming back all the time. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And there's a lot of like physical triggers of memory, too.
Yes.
There's a lot of chapters that reflect on or begin with the effects of a smell or a taste making a memory come back.
That's a good point, kind of Proustian almost. Now, Katie, please, go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's also there's this kind of structure thing she does, too, where the book is divided into these kind of sections. Like five kind of set, I think there were five, but they're marked with Roman numerals. So when you get to different parts of the book, suddenly you'll be in a new section. Mm. And it wasn't always clear. And she didn't explain what for her marked the beginning of the next section.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Sometimes it seemed chronological, but other times it seemed more ideological. And she was not going to guide you through exactly what was going on. And that, you know, again, it's more of that kind of disorientation, which I should full disclosure, I wasn't reading this book, Victoria, and thinking the whole time, the structure of this book's a reflection on trauma. That's actually not something that occurred to me until maybe yesterday. And truthfully, the reason it occurred to me is because, or maybe Wednesday was the day I was, that maybe that kind of started percolating in my head, because I only realized it in kind of thinking about my own experience with grief and the way that I'll think that things are okay for a little while, and then it will resurface in a super intense way. That happened to me. I had a bad day this week. I think that kind of started me thinking about that connection, right? That whether it's grief or trauma or whatever, that you know, we can have these experiences that, you know, everyone would like to hope or to think that just over time you'll get better mm-hmm. and it will fade or whatever. And, you know, and then, but it can always come back. And I think that, I actually think it's really interesting too, that she's trusting the reader to not explain that either. She doesn't explain that. She doesn't say, hey, get ready. This book has a weird structure and here's why.
Yeah, no, right. You know? Yeah.
She just jumps in and just goes.
And it's compulsively readable, right? Not to use a trite expression, but it is like, you can't put it down. And I mean, you have to put it down, but in a way you can't.
Yeah. Well, right. And interestingly, too, you can pick up and read this book at any point.
Exactly.
Like at one point, I skipped ahead a little ways just because I was interested to see what was coming. But when I got to the later parts, I thought, well, hold on. I'm not necessarily even seeing, quote, the end of the story here at the end mm-hmm. because she's been talking about it the whole time. Right.
Yes. Right.
Like, so even though it's very loosely chronological, it is in a way not. and is also very episodic and is very much focused not just on events, but also on ideas and also on feelings, and keeps circling back around to the same ideas and the same feelings, because that's what it's like to be a person and have something that you're struggling with or something that's happened to you, because it does keep coming back.
It does keep coming back. And I got to tell you that the reason when I sort of fell in love with this book and I knew that I would want to do a show on it was starting on page 4. This is just chapter 2, whatever you want to call it, right? Let me just read. She says, "The story of my body is not a story of triumph. This is not a weight loss memoir. There will be no picture of a thin version of me, my slender body emblazoned across this book's cover with me standing in one leg of my former fatter self's jeans. This is not a book that will offer motivation. I don't have any powerful insight into what it takes to overcome an unruly body and unruly appetites. Mine is not a success story. Mine is simply a true story." I immediately was just like, okay, this is already just a resistant, a revolutionary, a kind of just like memoir, right? We always think of memoirs as like, I'm sort of organizing my life to show you how I've had this success and made sense of my life. And she's like, I can't solve this. I'm not pretending that I can. And I'm going to go against every, you know, mainstream memoir about fat loss that there is and just tell you, nope, that's not happened. What do you guys think about that?
I wonder, my first thought in reading that after I already had read her 2018 essay about her bariatric weight loss surgery is I wonder if people are asking her to write a sequel of sorts to this that that discusses the fact that she made the decision to get rather serious weight loss surgery and what that means for the legacy of this book.
Oh, that's so interesting. I did not know about that. Victoria, can you talk a little bit about that 2018 essay?
Yeah, so there is a wonderful personal essay that she posted on her blog. I'll put the, oh, here it is. In her Medium essay, April 24th, 2018, What Fullness Is Roxane Gay on Getting Weight Loss Surgery. So I will link to that. But she talks about kind of the legacy of her assault. She talks about the history of weight loss surgery and what made her decide to get the surgery, especially as someone who was very publicly known as a body positivity activist,
right?
And kind of what that meant for her public reputation. It's a really beautiful, honest essay, and we'll link to it. But for me, I hesitate to say the shadow of that essay because that's a stupid metaphor, but I don't have anything else. I feel like the whole time I was reading this book, the shadow of that essay was kind of hanging over it for me.
That's so interesting because I was unaware of that. And so I didn't have that shadow. And I'm sure that she's gotten a lot of feedback for that. Right. And probably some negative feedback, right?
I mean, given the way that she kind of talks about
negative
it in
feedback,
the book.
Yeah.
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 That's so interesting. I wish I'd known about that so I could read it before the show, but that, you know, and again, that's of course totally her choice, you know, to do something like that, to do that kind of surgery. And it is a controversial surgery and it's a dangerous surgery, right? People have died, from doing that surgery. So, but there's a sense in which, this memoir kind of leads you to understand why she would take that risk. She's at every single point of this memoir saying, I hate myself, I hate my body, from beginning to end. And, you know, society wants me to hate my body. And it's just, it's a remarkable sort of pressure of that as it builds. And so I, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you all is one of the reviewers had said that anyone who has a body should read this book, which of course is everybody, right? Do you agree or disagree with that? And who do you think really would benefit from reading this book, I guess, is one thing that I would like to ask.
I don't know that I think that every person with a body should read this book.
Okay.
Mostly because I think that there are certain groups of people who are just never going to understand. And yes. I mean, and I would say now, but see, that's a hard thing to say though, because at the same time, then the other side of my brain immediately says, well, maybe that's why they should read it.
Right.
Like to try to help understand a person with a different perspective. So maybe I shouldn't say who shouldn't read the book. I think I'll say who probably should read the book. That's a better way to do it. I do think that it would be a great book for any woman to read, because I think that she says that a lot of the things that she talks about the pressure to conform to certain standards as a woman, I think that that is, I think that that is spot on. And I think that that's something that all women notice, at least, even if
yes.
despite the degree to which it affects them, right? So a woman who's naturally thin may not ever feel the pressures that Roxanne describes to lose weight, but she may feel pressures to stay exactly as she looks, right?
Yes.
Or whatever. Or she may even experience privileges and things that she's given in her life purely because this is her natural appearance.
Yeah.
And that's a positive effect for her, but it's still an effect. And then with that, there's also the threat that it could all go away in a second if you suddenly change how you look.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it can be particularly useful for women. I also think that it's a book that would be really good for anyone who's a parent to read. The ways that she talks about how her parents have interacted with her surrounding her body, I think would be good for any parent to read, just to try to help us remember that even when we're trying to help our kids, sometimes we can say things that can wound them.
Yes.
And that being concerned, truly deeply concerned about another person doesn't kind of insulate us against saying something hurtful or whatever. To me, though, and actually one of the saddest things to me about this book is really nobody's fault. One of the saddest things to me about the book is when Roxanne repeatedly talks about how she never told her parents what happened to her.
Yes.
Because she thought that they would react a certain way, when it turns out that they wouldn't have reacted that way at all, but she didn't know that. And they didn't know what happened, so they couldn't reach out to her about it. Right.
Yeah.
That kind of tragic miscommunication to me was so sad. I mean, you know, on top of what happened, to then, you know, for her to feel like she couldn't say anything. And so it was one of the best parts at the end of the book to me was reading when she talked through her, you know, her parents finally finding out what happened, because
yes.
she was publicly writing about it, and having that experience of her parents saying that we wouldn't have blamed you.
Right.
You know, this was not your fault. Like because she might, you know, she may or may not have thought she needed that 30 years later, but clearly it was a positive experience for her to hear that. So, you know, it's a good way to kind of keep in mind. And I'm not going to lie, it was interesting reading that stuff too, because, you know, I've got some baggage from when I was a kid, in terms of body image. Mm-hmm. And I've really been trying hard with my own daughter to be careful in the things that I say, the ways that I talk about myself, the ways that I talk about her, because I want her to be able to grow up and not have that baggage.
I know. And do you know any woman at all who doesn't have some baggage about their appearance?
You know, no, probably not.
Right.
You know, it's because it's, and I've seen lots of people writing in the last few years, and it's true that so often you can mess up your kids' relationship with their body or their relationship to food by not saying anything ever about their body, but by saying things about yours.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And that's really, you know, that's how it is. And that she doesn't seem to suggest in the book that was true for her. Right. And I think that's interesting too. One of the things that made this book an interesting read for me is so much of the things that I've read about women having complicated relationships with weight loss or things like that, a lot of times it is generational like that, but for her, it wasn't. For her, it was related to trauma.
Yep.
And so she wasn't getting she wasn't getting these messages from her parents as a little girl.
No.
Right. About her body. It
right.
was something that all happened because of a trauma in her life. And then kind of compounded after that. But the ways that she interacted with her family after she began this journey of gaining weight were damaging.
Yes.
So I think parents should read it. I think it's a good
book. Oh, I think that's an excellent point. And I wanted to point out too, that really it's a book about shame, and the power of shame to keep her quiet, to, you know, the trauma that she felt, you know, was somehow reflecting on her, if she told her parents would not, right. Like, this is so typical of this kind of trauma, right? There's no, this is not exceptional. And it's just truly sad. And that she, wasn't able to speak about things that feel shameful. And then she turned her body, and she says this several times, into a fortress to protect herself from being hurt. Right. Which is just a really thing that we do, right? Because of shame. So just want to point that out, that you almost could stack this beside something by Brené Brown and, you know, just, you know, have a fun time with it. So let's talk about the body, the woman's body in particular, but the fat person's body, because this is the way she puts it, as a matter of public discourse. Because that, to me, is one of the main concerns of the Christian Feminist podcast, is talking through that and how we can kind of move forward with that. You know, what's the potential for a memoir like this to change our thinking about that? Is there any potential for that, or is that just something that we have to put up with?
I absolutely think the book has potential to change thought about that. If you're open to it, as Katie said, if you can kind of let yourself be comfortable with the way the book makes you uncomfortable.
Yes.
I think that there's huge potential here. And really the, this idea of the body as public discourse, and what happens when you go through the world in a body that takes up too much space, really is where I started to feel the book kind of in my own bones, and really understand what she was talking about, and the radical notion of yes, I do take up too much space, and that notion of too much space has been unfairly and externally defined, and I refuse to let it make me less of a person in the eyes of society. Like, that's a very radical statement of acceptance.
That's good. Yeah, and of course, as we know from studying feminism in general, you know, all women perceive themselves as taking up too much space, right? And you know, we're taught how to be invisible. You know, there's that great Kate Bush song, How to Be Invisible. You know, you fold yourself up, make yourself quiet, keep your voice down, that kind of thing. And so it's already a step forward to you know, sort of speak your truth. But then if you are literally a person whose body is taking up more space, then it becomes a really radical move to just say, you know what, this is just what it is. This is the space that my body takes up, and it's your problem that you can't deal with this. You know, I mean, there's just so many heartbreaking stories, and I know because I've listened to other overweight people talk about the way they're treated on airplanes, public places where your body doesn't fit into, and the right that other people think they have to comment on what you're eating, that sort of thing is just, it's stunning. Can we talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah. Other people's right to comment on bodies existing in public is just unbelievable. Can I read a passage?
Yes, please.
That really, affected me in this vein. I'll preface this by saying, as a disabled person, I am someone whose body also gets commented a lot in public by strangers, to the point that I like have a series of comebacks stored away to deal with that
situation. The next time someone pats your head, like you're talked about before, right? You have a comeback. Yeah.
And I do have a set of responses for children and a set of responses for adults, which this paragraph kind of touches on. So this is the first paragraph of chapter 50 on page 173 in my copy. I am terrified of other people. I am terrified of the way they are likely to look at me, stare, talk about me, or say cruel things to me. I am terrified of children, their guilelessness and brutal honesty and willingness to gawk at me, to talk loudly about me, to ask their parents or sometimes even me, why are you so big? I am terrified of the awkward pause of those children's parents as they try to respond appropriately. I do not have an answer to that question, or I do, and there simply isn't enough time or grace in the world to offer that answer up, and so I am terrified of other people. And I I know I said this before, I'll say it again. I felt that paragraph in my very bones.
Yes.
Like I related to it so strongly. I've had so many experiences, and I know I've talked about this on this show, and I've written about it other places, of people staring and pointing and answering, asking rude questions, to me in public. And it's just, that is what existing in a disabled body in public is. And it'll probably always be that way. But, the thing that really was helpful to me about this book is how much the book recognizes that having going out in public be that way, being always on guard for the way people are going to receive you and feeling like you have to bear the emotional weight of that is exhausting.
It is exhausting.
It is just overwhelmingly exhausting to move through the world that way.
Yep. I can't relate to your specific situation, but I understand that in my bones as well. And I think the thing that makes her story, this is not to diminish what you just said, but to point out that the public at large thinks it's her fault that she's overweight, right? That, if you would just not eat that, why do you have those French fries? Do you see what I'm saying? So that's an added.
Oh, absolutely. Trauma. And I don't want to equate my experience with her experience. Though I'm talking about being marginalized in certain ways, I do benefit from thin privilege. Absolutely. So I don't want to equate those experiences, but I do think there is some overlap.
There's serious overlap, yes.
Of embodiment theory, the way that fat people and disabled people are marginalized in similar ways. But absolutely, I am a thin person, so I'm not speaking from that perspective.
You know, it made me think of something else too when I was reading it, Victoria, and I was thinking about this, Christina, with your phrase, like the body as a site of public discourse, but it made me think back to all the times that people felt free to comment or ask me invasive personal questions when I was pregnant.
Yes. Yeah.
Because there's something about, and I don't know if it's just the thing where any person who is in some way remarkable or looks different from other people. Right? A person who is larger than most people, like Roxanne, a person who has a disability that is visible, a person who is currently enormously pregnant. I don't know. But I don't know if it's something that people just feel like they can talk about you if you look different than other people. But that's the one time in my life that I kind of experienced that people just feel like they could say anything to me and say things that were kind of insulting, ask me invasive personal questions, things like that. And remembering back to those times and kind of thinking, oh my gosh, what would it be like if my whole life was like that? Right.
Yes.
You know, that was 9 months, four times.
Yeah.
You know,
and that was enough.
6 months of my life I had to deal with that.
Yeah.
And that was it. And, you know, but just that feeling of feeling like that my body was just public property, like as far as for people to talk about it.
Yep.
Say whatever they want to do. And I think that's one of the best reasons for people to read this book is to see it from the other side by reading about her experiences and not even to learn from the book that they shouldn't be insulting, because I feel like people should already know that, but you would be surprised. But just to think about the fact that even what they might think of as kind questions or expressions of concern or whatever, that's not how it feels to the other person, purely because you, a stranger, are talking to them about their body.
Exactly. Public. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And you don't have that right. You don't know that person. That's
right.
Not, you know, that's personal in a way that you haven't earned. And so I think that's another great reason to kind of read this and kind of see how, you know, because a lot of people might think, well, I would never insult a person for being much heavier than I am. Okay, fine. But if you regularly would feel okay just bringing up that person's body to their face in public, you're still imposing a burden on that person. It's not, in many ways, it's not about intentions at all. It's about what you actually do. And what you really should do is treat that person like any other person.
Right.
And if you wouldn't talk to any other random normal sized person, I don't want to say, I hate using the word normal, but like a non-overweight person, if you wouldn't talk to that person about their body randomly, you shouldn't feel okay doing that.
Right.
Because the person in front of you is overweight.
Or staring at them or whatever, like Victoria was talking about, just the exhausting being at the other end of that.
And it's tougher with little kids because they still have they don't this understand. Kind of like curiosity. And but that's why I think it's really important for parents to guide them in those moments.
Yeah.
And it sucks that, you know, like that she describes having to deal with that because kids don't understand. But it's still painful for her, even if a kid who totally doesn't get it and has no malice is going to ask questions about
her. Of course, it's painful.
Right. Yeah. Like this is why I have a separate set of responses for children and adults. Yeah. And I go about those conversations in different ways. But I've written about before in other places a time when I was walking down the street and a kid was staring at me and staring so intently that he turned around to keep looking at me as I was walking by. And it made him fall down. And y'all, I've never been so happy to watch another person fall down.
Oh,
And maybe that's terrible. I don't know.
No.
I mean, I don't think it's that bad.
That's how I felt in the moment. And I know it was just a kid, and I have no malice for that child. You know, bless him. I hope he's fine. But, like, the poetic justice of that moment was just kind of delicious to me. So I understand. I understand all of the series of emotions that is involved in those kinds of public experiences.
Yes. Now, Victoria, let me ask you, I love the way that you put that it's exhausting to go out in public and know this is going to happen. Right. I think that's spot on. And do you feel like, what do you feel is some insight you can offer about why people feel that they have the right to publicly comment? My gut is that it has to do with fear. But I wonder if you could reflect on what you think gives people the right to publicly react to you.
Gosh. I do think Katie is right that it is partially difference, that there's a kind of exoticism is too strong a word, but a shade of exoticism that just that's not what they're used to seeing out in public. And we see this even in just like legal history in the United States. Both fat people and disabled people were subject to what's called ugly laws in the early history of the United States. If listeners, if you're not familiar with ugly laws, Google it if you would like to be very angry.
They sound ugly themselves.
Yes. There are literal laws on the books, in some places still in the United States, though they're not enforced anymore, that if you are physically deviant in some way, disabled or in some cases fat people were also subject to these laws. You are not allowed to be out on the street certain hours of the day.
Good Lord. Good right. Lord Jesus. Honestly.
Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. So that's a real thing in the history of this country. People had to deal with. Think about the fact that that was written into actual legal statutes and what that means. But I don't know. I mean, I want to believe the best in people. Mm. So I think that mostly it's about just being confronted by difference and not really knowing what to do. Though I have had experiences where I think it has been malicious, particularly in religious settings.
Where the expectation is that you could be healed if your faith was high enough, that sort of thing?
Yes, sometimes in those situations. When I was a kid, people in churches, I don't have memory of this, but my parents have both told me that people often, depending on sort of denominational situations, would ask them what sin they committed to make me disabled and things like that.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So I've talked about this on other episodes, so I won't focus too much on sort of ableism in churches. But that's the space where I've seen kind of maliciousness happen the most, and I think it's really sad.
Yeah. Well, and the reason why I'm asking that question is because when you add the added dimension for the overweight or the obese person specifically, the assumption that it's their fault. Like, you could be thin if you just ate the right thing. If you add all that to that, then there's another dimension, right, to the public conversation, the public commentary on the person's body. Like, don't
right,
you
and
know?
And in a lot of cases, that is just as untrue.
I know.
As,
I know.
Like, yeah. You know, they can no more change that than I can my disability
yeah.
in a number of cases.
But their assumption is that they can. And that's what made me so angry reading this book, because as a postmenopausal woman who literally gained 25 pounds that no matter what I do, I can't get rid of, right? It's like, I feel people making that assumption about me all the time. You know, you obviously would be back to your, you know, premenopausal weight if you just ate the right things and did the right exercise and whatever else. You know, you feel that as a woman, you just feel it.
Sure. Like, and let's talk about how all of those prejudices are connected, right? That's sexism and
yep.
ageism
yep.
and, you know, thin, anti-fat prejudice. All of those things are inextricably linked.
Yeah. Like, women are not allowed to get old, fat,
right?
More visible, more, you know, an example of natural aging. They're just not allowed to do any of those things. And the question is why, and part of the answer has to be something along the lines of fear of death, right? There's something underneath it all that is really strange. Like, I need your body to be something for me, like, particularly as a man, right? I need, like, my experience is nothing like yours, Victoria, but I just want to say that when I was younger, and there is a freedom in being older because you no longer feel like you need to, like, men need your body to be a certain way when you're older. It's like they don't care. And there's a kind of freedom in that. Do you know what I'm saying? But when I was a younger woman and I'd be on the treadmill running and some older guy next to me would say something like, you should smile more, which just infuriates me, you know, as if my body and just my being here is meant to be a kind of a, I don't know. Do you know what I'm talking about? A kind of a.
It's female body as public property.
Yeah.
Like, no, sir, I do not exist to make you happy. Please go elsewhere.
it's just amazing to me. And so it's like akin to men, like, catcalling women or, like, making comments about them publicly as they're walking down the street, which Roxane Gay has experienced, of course, right? It's a horrible thing.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, too, because another thing that really resonated with me about this book is there are sections where she connects worthiness, internal emotional worthiness, with objectification. There's a worthiness that she feels within herself by being sexually objectified. And Christina, you just mentioned catcalling. The first time I was ever catcalled, I was incredibly happy about it.
Uh-huh.
Because, disabled bodies are often desexualized or asexualized bodies.
Right.
Okay. I was a very young person then. That was before my, first blind date with a disability fetishist, which we will not speak about.
Oh gosh.
It's a lot of stories. That's a story for a different day and probably not a public discussion.
Oh, gosh.
So I was, you know, very, very early in my feminist journey at that point, and all I knew was no one had found me sexually desirable in that way before, and to see that my body, the way I thought about it, could produce a response that was framed that way was positive and liberating for me at that point.
I totally get that.
I have,
because I grew up as a tomboy, and so for me to be catcalled had the same kind of, you know, because yeah, I understand.
Right, and I'm at a very different place in my life now. I have gone on a very long journey, facilitated by a very wonderful partner who has, you know, talked through kind of a lot of sexual hangups that deal with internalized ableism and also deal with the effects of Christian purity culture.
Yes.
Which I know we've talked about on this show ad nauseum, so I won't jump into that. But now I can kind of arrive at a more accepting place that, you know, bodies are bodies. Everybody has a body. My body does weird, funny things that I can kind of laugh at. But so does everyone's, and that's just a part of the human condition that I might experience in slightly different ways than other people, and all of that is fine.
Yes. All right. Well, let's talk about the Christian response that we had to this. As sort of Christian feminists, where were other places where you were, I'll just begin by saying for me, I just thought it completely 100% backed up the idea that the point of us being here is to love others in their otherness. And if that doesn't happen, it's destructive. And I just felt like there's a way in which this book just backs up the gospel of love, right? We love because God first loved us. We aren't worthy of that love. It doesn't matter. It's nothing we can do to earn it, attain it, whatever. It just is owed us by being made in the image of God. And the fact that she didn't get that, and that her earliest trauma was exactly not being treated as somebody in the image of God who has dignity, and, you know, her sort of early rape experience, it just made me weep for sin in the world. That was my just flat out Christian response, you know, like sin in the world is horrible, and look at the destruction that it wreaks.
Absolutely. And the fact that she, over and over again, in talking about why she did not feel comfortable talking about her experience, connects goodness and quietness and smallness, that those three things are inextricably linked for her. That quietness and smallness are akin to spiritual goodness. And particularly when she talks, she connects that with her, the Catholicism of her youth as well, which just made me very sad. It's awful. That's not what Christianity is or should be. Mm-hmm. Christianity is much bigger than that. God is much bigger than that. God's love is much bigger than that.
Yeah.
I think what you guys are saying is great. And I think that it's also, I would say that it's a good read for a Christian, even though she does make some of those connections, Victoria, right, to her kind of Catholic faith as a child. But she doesn't spend a ton of time on it. And I think that that also makes it an important read, because I think sometimes we have an idea of what we think is the usual narrative for a person who has deconverted because of something they've experienced, or, you know, a person who has experienced a shaming event, and then how that's worked. I'm not saying it well, but she keeps her story her own idiosyncratic personal story, and she's honest about what level kind of her faith played into that. But she also doesn't create a different narrative or give that more weight than it had for her.
Yes.
Or, you know, but reading it as a Christian, it does make me very sad that currently in her life she does not have that relationship with God, it seems, because, you know, one of the things that we believe is that God is the only person who can love us completely unconditionally.
That's right.
No matter what. And
that's the starting point for acceptance, right? Is that to know that Jesus is the lover of you in your wholeness.
Yes. I think that's it. I feel like I can read it and be happy for her and the place that she's in her life now and the journey that she's gone towards accepting herself. But it's also sad because I think, of, you know, the ways that God loves us and no matter who we are. And, you know,
which
that was
makes
kind
it,
of another.
Which makes it, of course, even more horrible that as a church, we're still not really good at just loving people the way they are, the way that God has asked us to love people, right? Because
yes.
It just makes it that much worse and that much easier for someone to blame their religious background. And I agree with you, Katie. I don't think she's doing that, right? She's not. I've seen that done We all have seen that
done.
Yeah,
and she could have done.
And she could have done, yes.
Yeah, but I think that she's, above all, honest. And that's another thing. This is not to do with the question about reading it as a Christian. But I really appreciated, too, that she never made any attempt to, you know, that she kept saying over and over, you know, this terrible thing happened to me, and then I made choices later that were destructive. And those were my choices. I made them. Like she, you know, she was telling, you know, the whole truth about herself, which includes telling you the times that she felt like, or she knew that things that she was doing were bad decisions. Yeah. And that, you know, that is, that kind of candor is so refreshing, because she's not trying, you know, she says, I'm not like you, that passage you read, Christina, she said, I'm not telling you a triumphalist narrative of successful weight loss. But at the same time, she's not telling you a story in which everything that ever happened to her was, you know, where she's trying to act like that everything in her life has happened, that none of it's been her fault, right?
Right. Because
that would take away her agency.
It totally would.
You know, she's being honest about being a person who terrible things were done to her that were out of her control, but she's also had the agency throughout her life to make her own decisions too. And she's not happy with all those decisions. She's a real person, you know, and I really appreciated that, because that also gives a true kind of picture of the destructiveness of having a trauma, and the ways that it doesn't just make you sad and feel depressed, but that there can also sometimes you can respond in a way that is destructive.
Right.
And that's another reason we shouldn't harm other people.
Right.
You know, but anyway,
no, the recognition of self-sabotage is one way to put it. Right. It really makes this narrative appealing, because we all do this, right? We all make decisions that we know are not for our best, in spite of what Aristotle, for instance, would have us think we're able to do, right? Well, you know the good, so just do it. Not so easy, right? And I so much appreciated the candor of this narrative for that reason. All right, any other things that you guys wanted to talk about as we're moving toward the end here? Anything more as a feminist or as Christians that you resonated with, or other things that we haven't talked about that you wanted to make sure we talk about?
I want to mention one more passage that I think on the surface does not immediately relate to Christian experience, but it's what it made me think of. In chapter 59, she's talking about restaurants and how it's difficult going to restaurants. So I'm going to read a little bit. There are very few spaces where bodies like mine fit. Chairs with arms are generally unbearable. So many chairs have arms. The bruises tend to linger. They remain tender to the touch hours and days after. My thighs have been bruised more often than not for the past 24 years. I cram my body into seats that are not meant to accommodate me, and an hour or two more later, when I stand up and the blood rushes, the pain is intense. Sometimes I'll roll over in bed and wince, and then remember, yes, I sat in a chair with arms. Other times I catch a brief glance of myself in the mirror, or maybe while wrapping a towel around my body, and I see the pattern of bruising inching from my waist down to my mid-thigh. I see how physical spaces punish me for my unruly body. The pain can be unbearable. Sometimes I think the pain will break me. Anytime I enter a room where I might be expected to sit, I'm overcome by anxiety. What kind of chairs will I find? Will they have arms? Will they be sturdy? How long will I have to sit in them? If I do manage to wedge myself between a chair's narrow arms, will I be able to pull myself out? If the chair is too low, will I be able to stand up on my own? This recitation of questions is constant, as are the recriminations I offer myself for putting myself in the position of having to deal with such anxieties by virtue of my fat body. I really appreciated that she went through that series of internal calculations, because when I enter new spaces, I have to do a similar set of calculations. Is this door push or pull? Am I going through it by myself? Where's the first stair? Is it marked? Is there a rail? Do I have to go upstairs to go to the bathroom? Does the chair have a back on it? By the way, if anyone who runs a restaurant is listening to this, please stop using those stupid light metal chairs that are only at high tables and don't have a footrest on them. I know that they're very trendy in your fancy restaurant, but they are awful and I hate them. And
they're also
use them
uncomfortable.
Again.
They're just
they're the worst.
They're the
for
worst.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, I really appreciated that list of questions because I think it's helpful to know that someone who is entering what should be a communal space, maybe it's not open and accepting and communal for them. And I think churches in particular need to think about this. Think about the way your services are physically oriented. Think about the accessibility that you have or don't have for lots of kinds of people. Are your services sensory friendly? Are they disability accessible? Are they fat accessible? Think about your sermons and songs, and are they exclusive or inclusive of various populations? All of these things are important as we, as the body of Christ, try to be welcoming to all people. So
that's well said.
And that's why restaurants made me think about church.
Yes.
That's, you know what, well, Victoria? It never occurred to me before, and I don't even know if this was the reason, but you know, we've thought a lot about disability accessibility at church because our church does a fantastic job with it. And that's one reason we're at our church, so that our kids have what they need. But it just occurred to me for the first time that if you were a person like Roxanne coming to our church, that it, at first I thought, oh no, this would be terrible because our church sanctuary mainly has those like fold downy movie theater style chairs where it's like very narrow and there's like arms and it flips up. But then I remembered that on the floor, in the flat part, not the risers part, but in the flat part, at the back of the flat part, there are actually pews though. So they do also have pews in our sanctuary. So then if you were a person who didn't want to sit or couldn't sit in a chair with arms, you could choose a pew. So that's actually kind of cool. I don't know that ever occurred to me before. I don't know if that's why they did that, but it's really cool. To be able to, like, we sit when we go to church, we sit in a pew that is in the very, very back against the wall on the left side because our son is willing to sit in the service but does not want to sit close because it's too noisy, even with his headphones on.
Oh yeah, we had the same thing. Yep.
So we sit in a very specific place in our church sanctuary, you know, but it's just interesting to think about that, all of that, the physical space and the physical challenges. And yeah, I hadn't thought about the chairs with arms things either. I always think of like plane seats as being terrible for anyone who's not like 17 inches wide.
Oh, she totally. Talks about. Yeah.
But I don't necessarily think about like restaurants, things that you do way more often than flying on a plane. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The last thing I wanted to mention, and I think one of my favorite things about this book, is that Roxanne makes very clear throughout the whole book, and she says something that I think is really important, which is that thinner is not always better. And she talks about it in the sense of, she talks about times when she's trying to lose weight and she starts to get thinner and she starts to feel, hey, I'm looking pretty good. I feel good about myself. And then the fear kicks in, right? Because like you said, Christina, she's always tried to make her body like this fortress against harm because of what happened to her. And so for her, getting thinner, a lot of times I think the narrative with weight loss and the culture at large is that getting thinner will always make you feel amazing.
Right.
Like that getting thinner is always going to have a positive.
That's the answer. That's the answer.
That it's always going to have a positive psychological effect on you. And so she's kind of saying, hey, that's not always true for varying reasons. You know, I have a friend who is a very different size now than she was in college. And there are a lot of people out there who might look at the change in her body and go, oh no, she must be so sad because she was so thin in college. But if you know that when she was so thin in college, she had an eating disorder and
right.
that at this weight, she's happy, healthy. She's like, she's thriving. Thinner's not better. Like,
right.
And I got a very, very small taste of myself, of that myself in the last couple of years. Cause back in like 2020, I went on a new diet I have a chronic bladder condition. So I went on a new diet and at the same time I did Weight Watchers because I felt like it would be a good idea. And I dropped a lot of weight really fast. I dropped like 40 pounds. And when I would see people out in public, people who knew me, everybody would be like, oh my gosh, you look amazing. And when I would look in the mirror, I would really like what I saw, but I did not feel good
you
in my body at
good.
That weight.
Yes.
I didn't feel good.
Yep.
I felt bad. All my hair started falling out. Like,
yep.
I mean, there were a lot of things about that that I would not want to be that. I'm not that weight now. I would not want to be that small again because even though everybody, it pleased my vanity to see myself looking smaller and because I think I'm programmed to think that's better, right?
You are programmed, right? Yep.
And other people, you know, wanted to compliment me because
yep.
it's not, you know, it is work. I mean, it's work to do, but it didn't feel good.
Yeah.
My
and
body
see,
did not feel good.
Katie, I'm so glad that you said that because, you know, one of the things that she asks at the end of this narrative is, does anyone feel comfortable in their bodies? And I would say that women are just programmed to not, like, to sort of by definition, you're just not allowed, you know, to be comfortable in your body, because the women right. who are in Hollywood
yeah.
who are attaining this, you know what they have to do, a lot of them, to attain this is feel bad. Like, you're talking, like, be in a body that actually is mm-hmm. not healthy for them. And I'm not talking about anorexia. I'm just talking about the thin, right? The people who have attained this sort of acceptable yes. level of thinness, particularly when they get older, when your body just does change. It, you know, I'm sorry, it does. You know, it's a normal part of being older.
Even those people are still being photoshopped in magazines.
Exactly. So, like, it's not worse.
It's just not, it's not winnable.
Yeah.
It's not really possible, given our society's values, I think, for women to feel comfortable in their bodies. And not just women, too. Like, men are starting to see more of this physical pressure to look a certain way. The beauty industry is kind of starting to target men even more, too. Mm-hmm. It's not escapable.
Mm-hmm. And it's really just so deadly. And I raise this again because I struggle with it. And I have all of the head knowledge I could possibly need and still struggle. Right? So what does that mean? That I can't escape it. And I don't know how to. I don't know how to get to the point where I'm just like, you know, this is my body right now. And I'm going to accept it.
I think I like that you said right now, because I think one other thing Roxanne talks about that I think is really great in the book is that she's also really honest about how there might be many reasons that a person might not feel good in their body at a heavier weight, like physical reasons. And she talks a lot about that, about like heartburn and, you know, all these different kinds of things that she has to deal with. But at the same time, like we've been saying, people don't always feel better or thinner. And I think that what you said, Christine, is the key, is to think about right now and to think about our specific bodies and our specific life context and the specific moments that we're in, and not always be trying to think of some objective standard, which doesn't even make sense. It doesn't make any mm-hmm. sense for there to be an objective standard of beauty, because every person has different DNA. Every person has different Correct. Life experiences, and our bodies change so much over the course of our lives. It's always made me sad to know women my mom's age who were like my mom's friends, who feel this pressure to somehow remain the same size that they were when they were much younger.
Yes.
You know, and like, my mom knows exactly what she weighed when she got pregnant with all of us. And to yes. me, that's a little bit sad, because she was, but I know it too.
Yes.
Right.
Yep. We all
and it's
do.
It's so depressing. Like, yep. you know, because the idea that you would, you know, my sister and I spent so much time over the years trying to get our mom not to weigh herself every day.
Oh God.
Like, because we're like, why, you know, why are you going to weigh yourself every day? But, and not, especially because, which, and this is also hilariously sad that I know this, when people are actively losing weight, they're actually counseled to only weigh themselves once a week. So you can actually see progress
right.
if you're looking for progress, if that's what you want. Right. Cause, you could eat a big pizza and weigh 3 pounds more the next day. It doesn't mean you're 3 pounds heavier now. Right. So we've spent all this time trying to get her to not to weigh herself every day, but that's what she does. Like, cause that's how she feels like she wants to do it. And so it's just it's a hard thing, because so much of it is just programming, and it's so hard to get deprogrammed.
It is, you know? So hard.
And I feel like that I, and, you know, and sometimes having what society might see as a positive bodily change can make things worse. So I had this big weight loss a couple years ago. Before that, I don't remember actively hating my body. I don't remember feeling like that I wasn't worthy, because I was at the heaviest weight that I'd been after, you know, I mean, I knew in my own mind, I've had 4 babies, like there's mm-hmm. no reason why I wouldn't gain weight. And so I don't remember, but I wanted, for health reasons, I wanted to try to drop some weight. Well, so then I did, I got so much smaller, I got all this affirmation. And so now, having put some of that weight back on, now I have more negative feelings about my body than I ever did when
oh,
I was like
gosh.
25 pounds heavier, right?
Yep,
it's
yep.
Because having seen what it was when it was smaller, and having experienced the reactions, this is one reason I love my husband, because, you know, he's not one for extravagant compliments, but at the same time, like when I was 40 pounds lighter, he's like, okay, cool. I'm glad you feel good. I'm glad that you feel like that was a positive change for you, right? Like,
yeah.
He wasn't giving me extravagant praise when I was 40 pounds heavier. He wasn't giving me negative comments when I was, or, you know, or
yep.
lighter. Like, no matter what size my body has been,
he doesn't,
you know,
care.
He's
about
loved
that.
Me the same, because
yeah.
because I'm what I am on the inside, right?
Yeah, that's the same way my husband is too, which is why it's so like annoying to me that I still can't get over it. Like, it's not my husband. My husband is not the one saying, you know, oh, you know, I wish you would get rid of these 25 extra pounds, right?
Yeah, so often I think it's how we think other women are going to react to us, not at all how men react to us.
Which is really insane.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's frustrating. And I think it's interesting. That's, I guess, maybe one of the few things that Roxanne, I feel like, didn't talk as much about in this book is, to me, she didn't seem to talk as much about how women, she was talking more about society in general and how everybody responds to her, to her body, you know, and particularly to how her family seems to feel about her body. But it is, I do think it is true generally that often it's women kind of putting pressure on other women, which is, yeah, it's frustrating.
And it was really interesting. For instance, she mentioned Oprah and how even Oprah, this multi-billionaire who, you know, has everything, still is not comfortable with her body. Right. And it's just amazing to think about that. It doesn't matter how much money you have, whatever. It doesn't even matter how good you feel. You still, right? Like, to your point, Katie, mm-hmm. like I went to my doctor and I just said, you know, what can I do about this? I think it's menopausal, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, well, do you feel good? And I'm like, yeah, I feel great. I have tons of energy, whatever. She's like, then forget about it. Right? Like, why are you worrying
about
it?
That's awesome.
You know? And it's just like, oh, wouldn't this be great? And there's actually been research that for certain types of illnesses, that people who have a BMI over 25 actually do better, survive it better, because gaining weight, there's a book out there called Nature Wants You to Be Fat, you know, is a way that the body kind of protects you against illnesses, because you have reserves, if you will.
I've definitely heard that too, with joint injuries and things with older people. With elderly people, it can be much safer if they're carrying some extra weight, because if they have a fall, there's something to, some cushion there, so that they don't break a hip.
And ultra thin people can be what's called skinny fat and be diabetic and do all of these things and be actually unhealthy. See, that's the other thing. Like, one of the things we were talking about is how, like, it's for overweight people, it's not necessarily at all their fault that they can't lose it. A lot of these people are not actually diabetic. Right, which means that their personal fat threshold, if you want to call it that, is like not been reached, and their body knows how to do the better thing, which is to add fat cells rather than just like putting on the visceral fat, right? So you can actually be an overweight person who is healthier than someone who is skinny fat.
Which I think that's a lot of that's what the Healthy at Every Size movement is about too.
I agree.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And why BMI is garbage anyway, right?
Oh, it's total garbage, and it's been lowered.
BMI was invented by a sort of not racist, but like a scientist who was operating on theories that we now think of as racist.
Yes,
that was talking about, you know, like certain types of bodies are healthier because of their bone structure. And the BMI was designed to reflect just men, not women.
Oh, yeah. And think about the differences.
English and French men when it was designed. So there's a kind of white-centric idea already at the center of it. Yeah. So
and how can BMI be the same for a man and woman? Think about it, right? Like, it's total garbage that men, like, are supposed to have less fat than women, right?
And are more likely genetically to have more muscle, which can also skew it.
Exactly.
BMI.
It's so ridiculous. And a really muscular woman who happens to be a little bit overweight is going to have a higher BMI because she's heavier, right? It is complete garbage, and it's been completely debunked, to your point, Victoria. And it was even lowered in recent years. Like, it, you know, so a whole, like a large number of Americans suddenly became overweight overnight, because the BMI was changed, you know? So it's ridiculous. Anyway, but that's something that has to do with what I'm going to pass on in just a moment. But are we ready to move on to the passing on section?
Sure.
Yep.
All right. Well, Katie, why don't you get started with that?
Okay. So my passing on tonight is actually something I read several years ago and remember liking at the time. It's an article by a woman called Lindsay Carlson. And the title, I'm pulling it up, sorry. The title of the article is 7 Ways to Love Christians Who Are Overweight. And it's from the end of 2018. But I really enjoyed this at the time. and I wanted to recommend it now because she's specifically talking about in church, right? So we were talking earlier about how Roxanne's book doesn't go a whole lot into that. So as Christians, this is very specifically, how can we love people in the church who are overweight? And she begins by talking about her own experience in church. You know, she's a pastor's wife, but, you know, of having an older lady at church invite her to participate in a weight loss program at church, or people who assume that her weight problems must be the result of sin, yes, of gluttony, you know. And so she spends some time talking about how, one, it's absolutely not true that it is always, or even mostly, you know, the sign of gluttony. She goes through that, and then she gives some kind of prescriptions for the church. How can we love people who are overweight? And, you know, it's just saying a lot of great stuff about seeing people as people, not as potential, you know, and not as whatever sin you think they've committed to make them look like they do. Don't shame, encourage other people. My favorite one on the list is number two, ask yourself if you are the right person to help, which I think was my favorite item. Basically that it's a sensitive and personal issue. And just because you see that I may be struggling with some weight issues, doesn't mean that you're the right person to step into that moment.
It's
a quick read. I really enjoyed it. So that's my recommendation. Lindsay Carlson's 7 Ways to Love Christians Who Are Overweight.
I love that, because there's nothing worse than like a person who, in my case, this happens to me a lot. Like people in my family who are already just super skinny and just by nature like are, they're like, well, I did this and then I ate chia seeds and I just dropped it. And I was like, just shut up. You know, it's like, you know what?
As if it'll definitely work for you. Yeah. If you do the same stuff.
Yeah. Like, do you know how many things I've tried? Look, you could, you know, if you tried half the things I tried, you'd be like, you know, size zero too. Right. So whatever.
That's like my husband being like, I just stopped drinking Mountain Dew. And I dropped
like, oh yeah. Oh, well, don't even begin.
That's a man.
It's a man. Don't even begin to talk about the issue about the difference between men and women on this. Like, that's a whole other, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh my goodness. But yeah, I really appreciate that recommendation. And did she go into it all? The how like certain, like being a missionary or whatever, not missionary, but college campus ministries, like what am I looking at? IVP or whatever had weight standards at one point, you know, like you couldn't be overweight.
No, and she didn't mention it, and I didn't actually know that.
I remember.
Yeah,
like Campus Crusade. I can't remember which ones, but there was like a.
Okay.
You were not even allowed to apply.
Oh my gosh, no. She's like a stateside residential pastor's wife, so she didn't mention anything like that. But she did give a kind of a shout out in the article to, quote, biblical diets.
Oh, really?
Which you sometimes see in the church space. Yes.
The Daniel plan.
Daniel, yeah.
Yes. Or she didn't go in depth about that stuff, which I've always thought of as nonsense, but she did kind of give and she also kind of mentioned somewhere in the article that people will kind of, the idea of weaponizing the idea of your body being a temple.
Mm-hmm.
And that one's always driven me crazy too, because that verse is about sexual immorality.
What
you eat or how much you exercise at all. So she kind of referenced some of that different kind of cultural Christian stuff that's happening around weight and exercise. So I thought it was a good read.
Great, thanks, Victoria.
So my recommendation is actually inspired by the previous episode of our show, and also has something to do with bodily representation. When I was listening to the Miss Marple episode, I was thinking of a mystery series I love very much, Robert Galbraith's Cormorant Strike books. I actually just pre-ordered the next novel, which I'm getting in the mail next week, and I'm very excited. Cormorant Strike is a disabled veteran who is also a private investigator. It's, if you like kind of dark thriller mystery novels, check it out. I really love it because it's solid disability representation. He gets to do things like have sex with people and be angry and, essentially just be a human person in the world, while also talking about his bodily experiences. So I am going to recommend those, with the caveat that, if you're not aware, Robert Galbraith is a pen name for J.K. Rowling. Not going to talk about or endorse social positions of hers. I just like the novels. That's my recommendation, the Cormorant Strike mystery books.
Thank you for that. That sound very interesting. I am recommending a podcast that I absolutely love called Maintenance Phase. And I got to tell you, just full warning here, it's full of curse words. And that's part of the reason why I love it. So you just don't want to be listening to this with any family around. But it's part of what makes it so funny. These are two podcasters who are self-declared overweight people. Aubrey Gordon calls herself the fat lady about town. And they just research the heck out of all of the health movements and the different diet phases and, you know, fad diets, and just show what's at the core of all the problematic things with the BMI, with the president's fitness test. It is one of the funniest things I've ever listened to. And I love listening to it because it keeps the perspective that I need to have about the whole weight loss thing that I'm frustrated with myself, right? So it gives wonderful perspective. And she often talks, Aubrey does, about the same issues that Roxane Gay raised about other people talking about her body in public and so on. And so it's just a really important podcast, bit of work that they're doing there. All righty. Well, that should wrap it up for today. Thank you for listening to the Christian Feminist Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. So if you've got a topic or reading recommendations for future shows, or if you just want to drop us a line, you can do so at christianfeministpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on our Facebook page or at the network's Twitter handle, @CHRadioNetwork. Check out the show notes from this and our other episodes at the Christian Humanist blog at christianhumanist.org. The Christian Feminist Podcast is a member of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Kristen Filipic is our press liaison. Tune in 2 weeks when we'll discuss the Netflix series Arcane. Until then, in essentials unity, in non-essentials liberty, and in all things love.